Hey everyone, it's Zach. Remember to tune in to The Last Dance, the behind-the-scenes look at the Chicago Bulls dynasty of the 90s. The series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby, two of my buddies, immediately following the broadcast, which is presented, of course, by State Farm and brought to you by AT&T. You can find Jalen and Jacoby wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a post Last Dance Monday morning, where I am back in the basement recording studio, and I'm thrilled to be joined by ESPN insider and longtime New Jersey Nets, almost New Jersey Swamp Dragons, and Brooklyn Nets front office executive, Mr. Bobby Marks. How are you?
Hey, Zach. How are you?
I'm good, man. I enjoyed episodes 3 and 4, not as much as episodes 1 and 2. But I am a Bad Boys acolyte, and I'm very excited to talk about the Bad Boys. But I want to give you the tee off spot, because you wrote a little bit about the New Jersey Nets faced the Last Dance Bulls in the first round of the playoffs. I remember literally nothing from the series, literally zero, because you have to understand, this is like, it's the first round. There's a million games to watch. I'm 20 years old. Like, even 20 year old nerd me had better things to do then watch Michael Jordan kick the shit out of the sorry-ass New Jersey Nets in 3 games. But one of the games was close. But you alluded to this in your little postscript on episodes 3 and 4. You guys had Jack Haley on the Nets in that year, and you gave Jack Haley a specific job for this series against the Bulls. Please explain.
Well, yeah, Jack's job was to take Dennis Rodman out before game one of the first round. And back then, the playoffs started on Friday. They didn't start on Saturday. The regular season ended on a Sunday, and we got in the last day of the year. We beat the then Washington Bullets. Ironically, we were supposed to play Miami in the first round, but we had lost 3 games in a row and had to win our last game. But I got to know Jack in those 2 years. We signed him to 7 contracts, 4 10-day contracts and 3 rest-of-the-season contracts, waived a couple of times, and we signed Jack 10 days before the regular season, and not knowing we were going to play the Bulls, we're going to probably play the Bulls or the Heat. And I remember, and we, you know, Jack's relationship with Dennis, and I wrote about it, is that, you know, they were with each other in San Antonio for those 2 years. He was on that 95-96 team in that won, you know, the first championship after the three, right, between that hiatus. And he had a great relationship with Dennis, and he always would say, like, he hated the word babysitter, right? That was always what people called him, that he was Dennis's babysitter. And I remember sitting in the breakfast room before game one on that that Friday morning, and Jack walking in and basically saying, sat down and said, "I did my job." I mean, so you don't know, like, what did you do? Like, what did you do this, man? Is he not going to show up? Is Dennis not going to show up? And if you go back and watch game one of that first round, Chicago wins by 3 in overtime. Dennis was terrible. I mean, 40 minutes, fouled out, no points and 8 rebounds, and was thoroughly outplayed by Jason Williams and Chris Gatling. And I think some of it had to do with Gatling basically just stayed on the perimeter and just jacked up shots and made, I mean, Chris was on fire that game.
You were going to say jacked up threes, but he jacked up 19 footers. That's what he jacked up.
It was a lot of mid range. And Jack basically kind of took Dennis out of his element, and they wound up winning. They won the series in 3, but yeah, I mean, so I kind of wrote about it. I didn't really throw the Jack taking him out night before part in that, in my little piece, but I think the interesting thing, Zach, with Jack Haley is that, and it hasn't been talked about yet. So I got to know him during those years in New Jersey and afterwards. And, you know, Jack played a huge role in basically getting Dennis to play in game 6 of the series against Seattle. Right? Yeah. Like, Dennis did not want to play at all. I think they had lost 2 games in a row. And he wanted to quit and go back home, and that was basically it. And Jack had to talk him into playing that game. And I think George Karl has been quoted to say, like, without Rodman, Chicago probably wouldn't have won that game. But he had like 11 points, 19 rebounds. He was like a monster in that. So I wrote a little bit about Jack, his relationship with Dennis, him taking him out before game 1 of that first round, and basically kind of like, you know, the, things like that don't exist now, right? Like things like what we've seen, we see on TV don't exist.
Dennis, so I loved Dennis Rodman, and I even loved San Antonio Dennis Rodman, who was a complete train wreck, and the Spurs hated him, and Popovich didn't just throw him under the bus. Popovich, like, tied him to the road and drove the bus over him after the Spurs traded him. They didn't like him that much. I had, in my room at home, I had posters, but I also would cut things out of Sports Illustrated and, like, make collages and stuff, and one of the centerpieces was one of those Rodman rebounds where he's got the ball above his head, his legs are splayed out in opposite directions, like he's trying to kick people on either side of him in San Antonio. And it was actually one of those things where Rodman was a very, obviously, a polarizing figure, but he was a generation gap polarizing figure. Like, my dad was appalled by Dennis Rodman. He was appalled that his son liked Dennis Rodman. And I just sort of, like, look, I'm 19, 18, whatever. Like, I'm not thinking about, like, locker room and chemistry and what a pain in the ass it is to deal with Dennis Rodman. I just saw an iconoclast and a rebel and someone who was cool and someone who was like nobody else in the NBA. And I loved Rodman and I still love Rodman. And when you talk to the Bulls guys, as I did, I've talked to a lot of the old Bulls guys for various stories that are out and coming out. Rodman, and this comes across, Rodman was very shy and soft-spoken and soulful. And it's tempting to reduce him to sort of a ha-ha-ha, he was in Vegas and Carmen Electra and blah, blah. But, like, he has a lot of problems. He still has a lot of problems. But he was very shy. And some of the Bulls guys who would go out to dinner a lot would tell me, Dennis would sometimes just sort of come up to one of us, like Kerr or Longley or Bushler, and just kind of say, hey guys, can you mind if I join you tonight? Like, is it okay if I come? And they're like, dude, of course. And then Dennis would be like, well, now I got something else going on after dinner. You guys want to come with me? And sometimes, most of the time they would say no because they knew what was going to happen. Sometimes they would say yes. And Judd Bushler told me, like, if you said yes to Dennis, you had no freaking idea what the next, like, 6 hours of your life is. He's like, all of a sudden, like, Billy Corgan is over there and Eddie Vedder is over there. And I'm like Judd Bushler, 10th man on the Bulls, just being like, yeah, I'm with Eddie Vedder. Dennis was one of a kind, and I loved him and I still love him. And he's one of my all time favorite players.
Well, it's almost like that hockey mentality, right? Like, these guys kind of live a different life off the rink. And I remember, this past June, right after the draft, when I was in New York, and I think I had to do Get Up or one of the shows there, and coming down that elevator, and Dennis was there. You know, Dennis was basically hiding out because there was paparazzi outside. And I don't get starstruck, Zach, by, you know, athletes, you know, just because we're around them. I was starstruck. I said, that's that, you know, you see him, he's got all, he's still, you know, he's got the hat on and he looked like he was on TV, but, and I think the amazing thing that we'll talk about is that the transition, right, from Detroit, San Antonio, Chicago, how much he was hated. You go back and watch that 30 for 30 on the Detroit team. I mean, like those, and it came out last night, but those teams hated each other, right? I mean, there was, and there's still like a distaste between.
Well, that's the number one argument. And I've gone back and forth and my thinking changes all the time. The number one argument against just put the 16 best teams in the playoffs and seed them 1 to 16 regardless of conference is that you will not get Detroit and Chicago playing each other 4 years in a row. It just won't happen. And, like, you go back and watch these things, that is awesome. I mean, like, these two teams, like, whatever the rivalry is, Pacers, Knicks, Heat, Knicks, Bulls, whatever it is, it's like when you face each other in the playoffs 2, 3, 4, I mean, 4 times in a row, the Pistons and the Bulls played each other in the playoffs. That's just awesome. Like, it's a little bit of a bummer that you have to wait 82 long games to get there and maybe a couple playoff rounds, but that is, you just can't duplicate in any other way the animosity and some respect, although I don't think there's a lot of respect in this case. You just can't duplicate that.
Well, and the funny thing too is when you watched last night, is like, I didn't even realize like teams played each other in conference six or division 6 times, right? When they did the piece on Cleveland and basically Mike was saying like, we lost these guys, just, you know, six times. We were like 0-6 against them and nobody gave us Nobody gave us a chance. And I think that's kind of where that distaste kind of stemmed for, where you weren't playing New York or New Jersey or even Boston two times, right? You played these teams, you know, six times, and then you had to face them in the playoffs for another six or seven games. I mean, that kind of lingers, that kind of carries over to the next season.
Now more than ever, we have to look out for each other and count on each other. Marathon wants you to know that you can count on them for the high-quality, top-tier gas. Marathon gasolines are formulated with STP additives. They keep your vehicle running at peak performance by optimizing fuel economy, removing those ugly deposit buildups, and by reducing emissions, which is important. We only get one Earth. And right now, you can get 5 cents off every gallon every day with Make It Count rewards from Marathon. Plus, you can earn points for additional savings on fuel, airfare, hotels, more. This is definitely a deal you can count on. It's quick and easy to join. Just download the free Make It Count app or go to makeitcount.com/radio and start saving today. This offer is valid only at participating Marathon stations. Remember, wherever you need to go, be safe. The people at Marathon are behind you all the way.
Let's talk about the Bad Boys a little bit, because obviously the flashbulb moment of last night's episode is Michael reacting to the Isaiah comments and saying, "You're never going to get this me. He wasn't an which was just the most fun thing about this so far has been Michael has been in the limelight more than any other athlete in my lifetime for essentially my entire conscious life as a sports fan. I don't remember seeing this sort of I'm trying to think of like funny. And you see the flashes across his eyes when he's getting really excited to talk about something. You see his eyes flash, and the wit and the quick wit and the lightning sharp tongue, and not just the swear words, but just the sharpness with which he's analyzing the game and all this. He just didn't give that part of himself to us as consumers growing up. I'm sure the people who got to know him well, Ahmad Rashad and Mike Wilbon, who's coming on the podcast today, and all those people have seen that. I just haven't seen much of it. It's been awesome to see that.
Well, I think the one scene kind of summed it all up, right? When they had gone through the part where the Pistons walked off the court in game four without shaking hands.
I can't wait to talk about that.
And you had the Isaiah segment, and then you gave Michael, I think, an iPad, right? To kind of watch what he was going to say. And I think that summed up, and you saw his eyes light up, right? And he kind of knew like what Isaiah was going to say already.
I've never seen Michael's face look like that before. It's a different, like, I want to freeze it and look at it, because I don't recall ever seeing that side of him.
Well, yeah, and he knew what he was going to say, and he basically called bullshit on it, right? I mean, that's the personality that we never saw when we watched this team in the 90s. It was just basically, you know, I'm going to rip your heart out. I'm going to win, and nothing, basically off the court. We never saw that. And that's the beauty of these documents that we're able to see this.
Here's my lukewarm take on the Pistons walking off the court. I thought it was cool at the time, and I still think it's kind of cool, because I was a sore loser as a kid. I'm still kind of a sore. I think like most people are sore losers. And I thought, I remember thinking there was a certain pridefulness to it. Like, they're not just sore losers. They're too proud to acknowledge that anyone has beaten them, let alone this team that they have manhandled for three straight years. I saw a certain pridefulness in it. I liked it at the time. I thought it was cool. Another father-son generation gap, because my father sure as hell did not think it was cool. I thought it was cool. And looking back on it now, I still kind of don't care. Like, I can't summon any morality rage about it. I don't care that they didn't shake hands. I still think it's kind of cool. That's my take, Bobby.
Well, yeah, I mean, you go back in history here, and if you watch the series before, and then you watch that, I mean, Chicago manhandled them, right? 4-0, swept them. I think Isaiah and Lambeer and that group knew this was the end, right? I think the beauty of it, though, Zach, is that how they had to walk across their, you know, in front of them, right? It wasn't like they beelined it and, hey, you know, you leave the court right behind you. But you basically walked across. And I think where I think where the criticism a little bit too is that, you know, you see the shot of Isaiah kind of ducking behind Laimbeer. I think people were saying, well, was he ducking? Was he just kind of hiding? Or is that how he was? But I didn't have an issue with, you know, back then. I don't have an issue with it right now as far as kind of what they were able to do. Could they have, you know, handed – it was basically handing the mantle over, right? This is kind of now we are giving you the torch to lead things on as far as, you know, we did it for the last 3 years. Now it's your turn. Yeah, maybe you could have done that, but I had no issue with it at all.
Well, it also was fitting for their team, right? Because their whole vibe was and I think they've owned this vibe a little too much, but we're the team nobody wants. We're the team nobody wants to win. You heard John Sally, the NBA didn't want us to win. All these teams are like the NBA was against us. They're like everyone, the NBA was against us. No, that's not really true, but I get what he's saying. And we played a style that everyone thought was ugly and everyone hated us and we didn't care. We don't care what anyone thinks. We own that. And walking off the court was the same thing. It was like, we don't care what anyone thinks. And Jemele Hill was tweeting about this last night. And I want her to come on to talk about it. That mentality of we're the ugly stepchild stylistically and market wise and lack of Isaiah Thomas was a signature star, but he was not Michael, Larry or Magic. And we play a style no one likes, and we're gritty, and we're nasty. That was Detroit, right? I mean, she will talk about that. That was the city of Detroit, and the meld between that team and that style and that city was really, really special, and still is really, really special. And people in Detroit, God bless them, they will never say a bad thing about that team. They are proud of how that team conducted itself. They are proud that they walked off the floor, and I think that's cool. I will say this though. Isaiah made Isaiah tried to draw an equivalence between the Pistons walking off the floor in 91 and the Celtics walking off the floor in 88. And it's not the same. It's not like I went back and watched game 6 of the 88 conference finals. Here's what happens. The Celtics are about to lose. There's a random foul with 3 seconds left that sends Adrian Dantley to the line. Everyone is already celebrating by that point. There are fans on the floor. Fans are on the court. Camera photographers from all over the court are storming the court. They're everywhere. They're not everywhere. They're not in the middle of the court, but some of them are actually. And so there's this vibe of like, it's now chaos a little bit and the game is over. And that's when the Celtics start walking off the floor. And you even have the public address announcer in Detroit saying, ladies and gentlemen, the game is not over. Please return to your seats. The game is not over. You have Billy Cunningham, who is the color commentator, saying the players might be leaving for their own safety because of this scene. And so this was the road team in a home arena that was going crazy and starting to storm the floor in 1988. In the year we're talking about, when the Pistons walk off in 91, it's a road team that's winning, a subdued home crowd, and the only people creeping onto the floor are photographers on the Bulls sideline trying to get a good shot of Jordan as they get to the finals, trying to snap that moment. So it's not the same situation, and Isaiah frankly is wrong to draw a parallel between. All you got to do is watch the tape. It's not the same. And so this idea that Bird walked off the floor and was forgiven for it, and Isaiah and Laimbeer and all them walked off the floor and weren't, is not. It's apples to oranges.
Well, you're right, and I think, you know, we're 30 years past from when this happened, and there's no turning back now, right? It's like you are basically going to go down in a blaze of fire, and you are going to own this as far as, and Isaiah has owned it, right? I mean, like basically, you know, he went back and used the Boston reference, what I had never heard before. Basically saying, well, this is what everyone did in the past, right? This is what Boston did. This is what we did. And I think Michael had a great, example when he says, well, no, you know, when we lost to these guys in those 2 years or those 3 years, like I stayed on the court. Like I shook everyone's hand. I didn't just walk off the court and beeline it. And it's funny, Zach, I got to know Rick Mahorn when he was in New Jersey I think he was there for a year. I think it was my first year. And Rick was on that first year team of the Bad Boys. And then again, they lost him in the expansion draft to Minnesota. And so he wasn't part of those 2 or 3 years. And I love talking about history. And I got to talk to Rick about it. The first Bad Boy team here. And he would say, like, there was such an edge to this group, right? It was basically take prisoners without asking questions. And he said, like, when they lost him to Minnesota and he wasn't there, like they lost a little bit of that edge, right? I mean, yes, you still had Sally and Rodman and Lambeer and stuff like that, but it was a little bit of a different group, and it was a little bit, I think you lost a little bit of some leadership. Would have things have stayed the same if Rick was there? Maybe they would have walked off the court. They probably would have. But I think it's probably two different groups there.
I actually think the Pistons have, well, first of all, and there was also the thing where the real Larry Bird handshake thing was not leaving the floor in game six. As I talked about, that was chaotic. There was a lot made, if you go back and read the clips, of Larry refusing to shake Lambeer's hand at tip-off of those games. And you want to play that card if you're a Pistons fan, that's fine. My response is, Lambeer played like an his entire career and fought with everybody. And if you play like an your entire career, people aren't going to want to shake your hand. You reap what you sow. And like, and by the way, as I loved Bill Lambeer. I loved him. And I think the Pistons have leaned so far into this. We're the little engine that could team that made up for, you know, maybe a lack of talent with grit and toughness. I think they've done themselves a disservice. That team was awesome and they were loaded. Like Bill Lambeer averaged like 17 and 12 multiple times, was automatic from 18 to 20 feet. Rodman is a two-time defensive player of the year and two-time all-star. Isaiah is, you know, one of the only players. He beat Larry, he beat Magic, he beat Michael. He's a stud. Joe Dumars is in the Hall of Fame. Sally was awesome. Mahorn was legitimately good. Vinnie Johnson was one of the great bench players in the league. James Edwards, in sort of edition one or two of the Bad Boys, was an elite post player. You go from Dantley to Aguirre. Like, that team, top to bottom, was absolutely loaded. Could go toe-to-toe. Like, yes, their number two guy isn't, like, whoever you qualify it as, whether it's Dumars or Rodman or Lambeer, whoever you want to call it, their number two guy is not Kobe, it's not McHale, it's not, you know, Kareem or Worthy, whatever you want to say. But 1-8 in terms of their talent level and how their pieces fit together, they were absolutely loaded. Like, they're not some little engine that could team that got by with toughness. Yeah, they were tough as hell. You didn't want to play them. They would knock your ass to the ground. But they were also awesome, and they were worthy champions. It was funny to watch this with my wife last night, who doesn't know NBA history like this. She just thought they were mean. Like, isn't that against the rules, what they're doing, throwing them to the ground? And then they're showing them spraying champagne. I'm like, no, they were just a straight-up awesome team. They won the championship 2 years in a row. By the way, if Isaiah doesn't get hurt in 1988 and there's not a controversial foul call on Lambeer, I believe, guarding Kareem at the end of Game 6 in L.A., they might three-peat. Like, they were inches away from a three-peat. They were a legitimately awesome team, and for some reason, because they're this interregnum team, they're known as sort of these interloper overachievers. No, they were just awesome.
Well, and, you know, I think when you look at – and the one thing, too, is that it wasn't documented last night, but when you go back and watch that 30-for-30 is the Aguirre-Dantley trade, right? That basically kind of changed the landscape of that group, because it kind of gave everyone different roles and more defined roles. The amazing thing, Zach, with that group is that the rules never changed, right? Like, I think it would have been easy for the NBA and for Commissioner Stern and for Rod Thorne, who was on there and I worked for 10 years, you know, to come in after their first championship and say, like, all right, this is what we're going to do now, right? Flagrant fouls, you know, technicals, we're going to up the ante on everything and basically kind of take that group out of their element. I think it would have been easy for the league to come in and do that. There was a segment where it had how much they were fined, I think, the year they won a championship. You know, they were only fined like $34,000, I think, for the whole year on like technicals and flagrants. I mean, in this day and age, I mean, that would have been millions of dollars. And, you know, down the road, yeah, things changed. But the league allowed them to kind of go about what they were doing.
They weren't the only team to do this. Like, if you talk to the Pacers teams that pushed the Bulls really hard in 1998, that one team that took them to seven, you know, one of the things that happened in that series was Phil Jackson very smartly put Scottie Pippen on Mark Jackson and was like, just shut him down. Just take him out. Pick him up full court. You saw him pick up Magic full court in the 91 finals, the first championship the Bulls won. Scottie just essentially beat the hell out of those guys up and down the court. Today he's fouling them three or four times when they're bringing the ball up. All of those teams, it wasn't just the Pistons, all of those teams took advantage of the leeway you got back then to play physical defensive basketball that you just can't do now. And Scottie was just as good at that as the Pistons guys were, maybe not in sort of a, like, he wouldn't be the guy to shove you after the whistle into the freaking basket stanchion or the first row, but like, he was a physical, physical defender.
Well, and you're right. And I think the one thing that's underrated, and I think when we learn, as the episodes go, is how great of a coach Phil Jackson is, right? I think X's and O's, yes, but the ability to manage that group, that locker room, especially that last year when they were basically all lame duck, how to handle different personalities. Certainly, I mean, I loved when he got on the board and basically showing you how the triangle worked, right? I mean, yeah, that was a great moment, but I think how he basically kind of allowed guys to be themselves and how he handled that, I think that's probably one of the more under the radar out of the first four segments is the ability of Phil Jackson.
Well, as many people were commenting last night, can you imagine in the age of Twitter and Instagram, what in the hell would happen if the third best player, an all-star level player on the team that was the Beatles, just took a freaking vacation to Las Vegas for a week doing God only knows what with God only knows who? It would be 24, like, I don't think he would actually be able to do it because he would be followed around everywhere. Every single thing he did would be a story. And Phil gets a lot of credit, I guess, for understanding that, yeah, Dennis just needed to go get it out of his system and we would play on without him and then he'd come back and he would be good. But that is, that today would be, it would blow everything up, not just Twitter, it would blow the whole world up.
Well, I don't even know if that, I mean, how would that team have been able to manage in this day and age with social media, everything around compared to where they were in 98, right? I mean, could that team have survived in this day and age? Basically all guys, a coach who knew he wasn't going to be back, basically half, most of the roster on expiring contracts. I don't know. I mean, maybe they were mentally tough enough that they could have done it, you know, in 2020. But to be able to go through that season as is with your second best player missing the first game, first 38 games or 44 games because he had surgery before training camp because he was basically pissed off that because of his contract situation. And then Dennis leaving in the middle of the year to take a 48-hour hiatus and basically Michael basically carrying the load. And I mean, that roster was filled with role players, right? I mean, you look at that roster from Harper to Kerr, Randy Brown, Kukoc was certainly a good player, but most of that is a group of role players.
The Low Post coverage of The Last Dance is brought to you by State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Coverage is also brought to you by AT&T.
Let's make another thing clear, by the way. 1990s Madonna, 98 Madonna, where? Top five coolest person in the world. If you're hanging out with Madonna in the 90s, you can't get any better than that. She's the coolest, most interesting person in the world. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but you know what I'm saying. Like anyone our age is like Madonna in 1998. Oh my God. You said something else interesting. So I'm watching this. So two things. Number one, I want to read something about if they had kept it together, would they have been favorites the next year when it's the weird lockout year? Now, obviously, I had forgotten that Michael hurt himself in that offseason. He had a finger injury cutting a freaking cigar and might have missed most of the 99 season. But I do – like, Michael was 35. Scotty was 33. That's about the age where you do start to worry about it. But I am big into, like, there's a certain honor in being champions. And I do sort of buy the idea – I mean, 33 is not ancient. Back then, it was older than 33 is now, given sports science. They're not ancient. Michael is still the best player in the NBA. I do think there's a certain honor in you play it out until you can't win anymore. You let a champion deserves the chance to lose. And I do think, rest his soul, he's not here to defend himself. I do think Jerry Krause dishonored that a little bit. Now, maybe the personality dynamics were already broken to the point that they could not be fixed, right? Pippen's been bitter for so long. Phil's tired of coaching. He's coached longer than he wanted to coach the team. Maybe it was just going to break up anyway. But I would like to read an analysis of if Jordan's 36 and Pippen's 34, would they have been favorites that next year against a kind of, you know, a Spurs team that was old and then had the young superstar in Duncan and played an eighth seed in the finals, now not your typical eighth seed. I do, obviously, you know, I think Jerry Krause probably sensed this, like, as a front office executive, you are lauded. You can speak to this. You are lauded for thinking ahead and not being the executive that hangs on too long. Think of how Danny Ainge, I'm sorry to bring this up, gets lauded for what he got from you guys in Pierce and Garnett, who were still really good. And yet there were people who thought the Celtics had sort of hung on too long to that team, to that group. And so I get what Jerry Krause is going for. Like, you don't want to be the guy that hangs on too long. And the way to become the celebrated GM is to outthink everybody else and be ahead of the game. But there's just an honor in playing it out until you're the team walking off the court like sore losers.
Well, and they also had an advantage. If they wanted to keep that group together for 98-99, they had an advantage because it was 50 games, right? It was basically a sprint. We started, lockout was lifted in January. We went from, I think, end of January until, I think, May, 50 games. And if for a team that's a veteran, aging team, basically that's the perfect scenario, right? Like, to keep that group together. I think the hard part would have been, as far as what do you, you know, you had Pippen, who is, was looking for that big long-term contract, and he wound up getting it in a sign and trade, going to Houston and then eventually to Portland. But I think you had Kukoc was under contract. Harper was under contract. Randy Brown was under contract. You had some of your core guys, still there. So yeah, if you wanted to keep it together, I think you certainly could have. I think when you're looking to try to break it up, and when you go back and you read some of the Pippen's trade stories, is that, you know, like, you know, Krause was trying to move him to where? Boston for what, 3-6 that year? That wind up turning into Chauncey Billups and Ron Mercer. So he was looking for that.
And by the way, if you make that trade and you hit it, you're a genius. And I think Jerry Krause probably sensed that, and that the time was running out. And like, if I hit one of these, I can become a team that's an elite for 20 years, which is what the Spurs were trying to accomplish in trading for Kawhi. The difference is the Spurs didn't trade they didn't trade Scottie Pippen. They traded George Hill, right? I mean, it's like, you can't trade Scottie Pippen. I get it. I get where Scottie's coming from. I'm Scottie Pippen.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, and I think where Krause is coming from is that he saw that 90 or 97, 98 was it, right? It was going to be it. And if you have an opportunity to move him for Sean Kemp or to try to trade for Tracy McGrady and to maybe keep, you know, this roster together, but I think probably things would have went sideways with Jordan and certainly with Phil Jackson not being there. That's the discussion that you have to have internally, but you play it out, you win a championship in 97, 98, and then basically, it's basically a self-destruction, right? I mean, all those guys that were wind up, you had Pippen, Kerr, Judd Buechler, used in signing trades, like nothing ever result. You never got anything back of value from that group there. So basically it just ended on its own.
The other thing I was thinking about last night is sort of the stories we tell ourselves. And so the story of the Bulls team is that they lose three times in a row to the Pistons, and then Michael starts lifting weights and they get tougher and they push back and they decide we're going to be the one that administers pain. And Michael, one of my favorite moments of the documentary last night was Michael telling Horace Grant, stop whining, because when you whine, they know they have you. And those are the stories that make us love sports, right? Like, we have to believe that that's what happened. Iron sharpened iron and the Bulls got tougher. And I do think that happened. I was curious to look back and think, I also wonder, most of the times when there's a transition of power like this, it's just that one team got old and a younger team got more experience. And I thought, not to be the turd in the punch bowl guy, but like, isn't that what kind of happened here? Like, the Bulls entered their primes. Michael was 27. Horace and Scottie were 25. The Pistons exited their primes. Like, the toughness stuff, that's cool. That makes for good storytelling. That really happened. You know how old Joe Dumars was in 1991?
I don't.
27. Isaiah was only 29. Now, the other guys were older. Lambeer was 33, but like 27 and 29. Now, Isaiah left it all on the floor. His career ended, I think, earlier than most, than what it would have ended today. But the Pistons, this was not just a case of Detroit getting old. Like, their two best players, and Rodman was not old yet. Like, they were still in their primes. Now, there was a case of the Bulls gaining experience and the things that happened to younger teams. But in my head, I was like, I wonder if we've all sort of tricked ourselves into this story of toughness and this. The Pistons, like, they weren't that old. It wasn't like they were an ancient team.
Well, and Isaiah, when he tore his Achilles, was 32, right? That was it. I mean, that's all. I mean, he never played a game after that, I believe. The Dumars thing is fascinating. And it basically just like, the years of that grinded out, you know, knock you on your ass, you know, took its toll on this team, right? I mean, that's the reality of it.
If you're looking for more Last Dance coverage, and who isn't, there is a new episode of Detail on ESPN Plus with the one and only Dennis Rodman analyzing Chicago's 111-105 regular season win over Dallas on December 29th, 1997. That's now available. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com.
A couple more things I want to say. First of all, the NBA on NBC theme, everybody loves. The old CBS NBA theme, underrated. People, and Dick Stockton was the voice of my childhood on NBA on CBS before NBC took the rights. So that, I was watching 88 games. Just go think of that. Number two, let's end here. Do you think Dennis Rodman belongs in the Hall of Fame?
Yes.
He's in. Do you think he belongs?
I do. I mean, two different dynasty teams, Detroit, you know, and those, for those, you know, 2 years and certainly leading up into that. And then what he was able to do in Chicago for those 3 years. Yes, I do believe.
I was texting back and forth with a coach who shall remain nameless, who disagrees and thinks that Rodman, and the comparison was made to Draymond Green, that these guys are not Hall of Famers. They're very good players who do the dirty work and are lucky enough to play with the real drivers of offense and scoring and what happens. And they're not really Hall of Famers. I'm sympathetic to that argument. I get that argument. Dennis Rodman is the greatest rebounder in the history of basketball. Period. Point blank. That's it. And we have all these coaches, you know, Pat Riley, you don't rebound, no ring, no ring, no rebounds, no rings. You know what I mean? Like this and that. This dude is the best at it. Ever. You look at Basketball Reference, there are 16 seasons, individual player seasons ever, where any player rebounded 25% of all misses when he was on the court. 25%. One out of every four misses. 16 times it's been done. Rodman is responsible for 6 of those seasons by himself. He is the best rebounder ever, period. He was a Defensive Player of the Year 2 times in a row. Not just a good defender. You watch these old games, he guarded everyone. He's guarding Magic, then he's switching on to Kareem, he's guarding Bird, then he's switching on to Ainge and Parrish and McHale. And so he wasn't just a really good dirty work guy, he was the best dirty work guy. And even rewatching those 97 and 98 finals against the Jazz, there are 6 times in critical fourth quarter situations where he just, through sheer force of will and physicality and desire, trucks Karl Malone. Trucks, and this is Karl Malone, who literally, like Rodman, was so chiseled he went to professional wrestling for a second because he looked the part. Trucked him and got the Bulls extra possessions and extra points that they would not have gotten. There are 3 rebounders in the history of basketball who would have made those plays, and they're the kind of plays that swing championships. So and Dennis Rodman is only a 2-time All-Star. That's on the lowest 1 percentile among players who are in the Hall of Fame. If you are that good at the dirty work job, and yes, you're lucky enough to play with Michael and Scottie, that's luck. That's the way the balls bounce. I think he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, and real quick, I mean, I think the segment last night where, and I think the impression of Dennis is that basically he just rolled out of bed and played, right? But like, they showed him and he said like, hey, I studied how guys missed, right? Like, I knew when Michael would miss or Patrick Ewing would miss, like kind of the angles of where the balls were going. And you see him watching tape and studying and, you know, they, you know, like came out, hey, he's one of our smartest players, right? Like,
It's not self-mythologizing either, because Kukoc, I wrote a big story on Kukoc today, and he loves Dennis, and he talked a lot about Dennis, and he said, I would sit there and watch Dennis watch other players shoot in warmups, watch other players shoot in tape, and study where the ball. So it's not just Dennis self-mythologizing. It really happened.
No, you're right. I think last night kind of summed it up for you.
So I'm all for Dennis being in the Hall of Fame. I do think there's an interest. The counter argument to that would be, is there any universe in which I'm just picking a name out of a hat. Chris Webber is a better basketball player than Dennis Rodman. He's just better, right? Like, he can score, yeah. He can pass, he can do stuff with the ball that Dennis Rodman just can't do. And I've campaigned for Webber to get in the Hall of Fame. He's my pet case, so I'm the wrong person to ask about this. And I, like, Mitch Richmond is better than Dennis Rodman. I mean, I guess Dennis could never do, Dennis is not going to take a 25 win team and be the number one option and make them a 40 win team. I get that argument, but, you know, if you do what he did on championship teams, I'm okay with him being in the Hall of Fame, and players of his ilk being in the Hall of Fame.
Well, you're right. And I think that's the same thing with Draymond, right? Is Draymond going to take a 23 win team and win 44, 45 games? I don't think so. And when you look at Mitch Richmond and Webber, you know, guys are, you know, skilled players, guys that scored a lot of points, Webber did a lot of good things. And I think he does deserve, you know, to be in the Hall of Fame, but I think it's different when you were kind of comparing, because of basically Rodman was, and same as Draymond, the glue guy, the guys that did little things, guys that they wouldn't be, you know, we started this podcast and I said, we talked about that Seattle series, right? And George Karl came out and there's a great quote. And he says, like, without Dennis Rodman in that series, like, Chicago doesn't win the series. So I think that,
but people say that, and Dennis said that. It's not like if you take away Dennis Rodman, you're left with me, right? If Dennis Rodman is not on the Bulls, they could get another power forward who's maybe 70% as good as Dennis Rodman. People frame these arguments as if you just vaporize Dennis Rodman and all of a sudden Judd Bushler is starting or Zach Lowe is starting, and that's not the case. But he is better than everyone else at that job. That's the bottom line.
You're right. No, you're right.
Bobby, go back to quarantine family life and homeschooling and all that. Read all of your stuff. You've been keeping us all on point about what the hell's going to happen with the NBA, which I don't have the emotional bandwidth to talk about. Thanks for some reflections on Jack Haley and Dennis Rodman, and I hope to see you soon, like in real, actual life.
Thanks, Zach. Appreciate it.